uhuru wa mazungumzo kwa watu walio huru.
हम ताकत के सामने भी सच्चाई से बोलते हैं. हम हैं पैसिफिका रेडियो KPFT 90.1 FM.
Let's all get together and pray for the peace.
The Unruffled Beat of Clouds Below Your Knees by Ray Lynch signals it is Wednesday, 8 p.m., and time for So What's Your Story? We are the only program originating in Houston, Texas, devoted entirely to storytelling, right here on listener-sponsored KPFT 90.1 FM. And we are so excited about our new time and our expanded format. If you were expecting Technology Bites, please stay with us because we've been around quite a few years on Thursdays at 10 p.m. and our team would like nothing more than for you to keep your 8 p.m. Wednesday tuning habits just as they are. So give us a shot. I'm Greg Audell of GPA Productions, and I am thrilled to be your host for the next hour. Along with our team, co-hosts Mary Edgerton, Warren Holloman, Hank Rubicek, engineer Nicole Rocherlon, syndicator Alondra Mejia, and Lisa Moore, and of course, Floyd the Wonder Dog, we celebrate the power of storytelling by placing the spotlight on tellers who take us on journeys through unfamiliar worlds and through the windows of their souls with personal stories that stretch the boundaries of the human heart and always seem to treat us to new perspectives. I'm excited to tell you about tonight's guest, Dr. Michael Schaefer. He had the good fortune of enjoying a seemingly idyllic youth in the small town of Norton, Kansas, where his father managed a grain elevator. Then Michael broke free from his small town roots and went to Germany, Paris, and Chicago for his post-medical school training in plastic surgery. He practiced pediatric plastic surgery in Chicago for 30 years. And throughout his years of practice, Michael also volunteered his time doing overseas medical missions while raising three children who have provided him and his wonderful wife, Ellen, with six grandchildren. Michael's been a volunteer at KPFT, which is one of my favorite kind of people. And just while talking to him, I realized that he has a lifetime of powerful stories that I thought our audience would be as captivated as I have been. So, Michael Schaefer, welcome to So What's Your Story?
Well, thank you very much, Greg. This is a real thrill for me to be to participate in your show and especially in your new format. So I'm just so happy to be here, and thank you for the invitation.
Well, absolutely. My biggest problem with having you on is I've heard so many wonderful stories for you. I wasn't sure how we were going to narrow it down to just two. So I'm looking forward to the ones you've selected for tonight. But I'm holding out hope that we might get you on again at a later date. You are my first guest in our new hour-long format. And it was nice to have a friend, you know, as I navigate this hour. But I have a feeling that this hour is going to fly by. You know, Michael, country singer Kenny Chesney said, "I grew up in a small town, and I grew up in a place where your whole world revolved around friends, family, school, church, and sports." And I'm wondering if what he says kind of smacks of Norton, Kansas.
Oh, Greg, I think he could have taken that line right out of the Norton playbook. He's been reading our paper because that's just exactly how I would describe how I grew up and the people and the places from which I've come.
Sounds like a mighty nice way to grow up.
It was a wonderful place to be from. When I was there, it was a nice place to be, and now I look back on it with nothing but fond memories. It was a good place to have my beginning.
Well, it seems to me that your hometown is the antithesis of 21st century Houston. And I know that you and Ellen chose to move here after you both retired. And I've got to ask, why Houston?
Well, there's the short answer would be Chicago winters.
That's a good one.
The longer answer would be Ellen grew up here. This was her home until she married somebody else and moved away. And then when we retired, we thought we should come back here where it's just so beautiful. She had friends here who have become my friends, and we just really, really enjoy living here. And it's a wonderful place to be right now.
Well, how has Houston treated you or surprised you?
Well, I feel like I had kind of an introduction to the city and the culture through Ellen. She still has many friends here with whom she went to school and who also have moved away and come back, some of them. They have now become my friends. So I had this little coterie of friends within just a very short while of our being here. We came here periodically when Ellen's mother was still alive. So we'd come for a few weeks or a couple of months at a time. And so we kind of got used to it and then decided about a year ago to make this our full-time home. And I just love it. I love being here, and I love the people that I've met. And, you know, I've spent the last 50 years in another big city, so being in a big city is not that strange to me.
Well, I can say that Houston, KPFT, and even Floyd the Wonder Dog are better off for it. Floyd and Michael have become very good friends in the time they've been here. I want to thank you for sort of placing the image of your hometown in our mind. And with all that wonder, happiness, and family, while it sounds idyllic, your first story is about something quite different and even quite difficult. Would you tell us about it?
Surely. I'll be glad to, Greg. I've entitled this No Tears in Norton, and you'll see why as we go through this. It began as an ordinary day in my hometown, Norton, Kansas, a little town of 4,000 people on the edge of the prairie where time stands still and not much changes from one generation to the next. It's a town where restaurants are judged by the number of different kinds of Jell-O salad at the salad bar, and hors d'oeuvres at a successful dinner party are cubes of minced ham and Velveeta cheese skewered on a toothpick, and, of course, swirls of Cheese Whiz on a Ritz cracker with a slice of pimento olive on top. It's a bustling little town. With good schools and good athletic teams, it was mostly a happy town. That is, it was a happy town till tragedy struck one day, tragedy the likes of which the people there had never experienced before, nor have they since. It shook the town of Norton, Kansas, to its very core. Three men died that day in a grain elevator accident. Gene Schaefer and Paul Stutterheim had been partners down at the Ralph Rich Grain Company for about 35 years. They were both just getting ready to retire and had turned the management of this country elevator and grain business over to Paul's son, Don Stutterheim. However, both Paul Stutterheim and Gene Schaefer continued to come down to the elevator almost every day, mostly because they just couldn't quite let go, couldn't stop doing what they had been doing for all those years. They came and sat and talked to the old friends and chatted with customers. I think they also wanted to kind of keep an eye on things to make sure they stayed running like they should. Leo Dirks had been in that morning to settle up for his wheat harvest, and Tom Melroy was just pulling out in his big rig, loaded with livestock feed of rolled oats and molasses to feed his cattle. In fact, Tom had gotten the last of the molasses stored in the pit where it was kept to be mixed with the grain as it tumbled down into the chute and was augured up into the waiting truck. Don Stutterheim was out in the driveway of the elevator that morning making his rounds to see that everything was working as it should. There were three workmen, all doing various chores around the place. Harold Wiltfong had been there the longest, probably 25 years or so, and was the senior man of the group, also the one who could talk the most and the longest while leaning up against a customer's pickup truck, all the while with a toothpick or a wooden matchstick dangling from the corner of his mouth. Darrell Kieswetter and Phil Pogue had each worked there 10 or 12 years, and each knew his way around the place, and they were the best of friends. After the last load of rolled oats and molasses was finished, Phil Pogue looked down into the molasses pit and saw it was completely empty. He decided to go down into the pit and sweep it all out before pouring in the next batch of that sticky, sweet-smelling brown liquid that the livestock loved so much and made them eat more grain so as to fatten them up for market. Phil grabbed a broom and climbed down the iron-runged ladder into the depths of that molasses pit. Several minutes went by, and Darrell Keyswetter realized he hadn't heard a sound since Phil had climbed down into the pit. He looked down and saw his friend slumped motionless on the floor. Without thinking, he then slid down the ladder to help his friend. He did not come back up either. Now, Don Stutterheim, the young manager, was nearby and must have sensed that something was wrong. Both men had disappeared, and there had been no sound. Don looked into the hole and realized what was happening. He saw both his men on the floor of the pit. He gave a blood-curdling cry for help and slid down the ladder himself to try to rescue his men. Don didn't come back up either. The volunteer fire department was called, and they came with their oxygen tanks and went down into the molasses pit and hauled out the three men one by one. All those men were known by everybody in town, and especially Don. He was young and had a little family, and he was truly loved by everybody. He had indeed died a hero's death, for he surely knew what was happening, and even so, plunged down that hole to try to rescue his men. These men died not from poison gas or a toxic residue from the molasses, but rather from the total lack of oxygen in the depth of that pit. The volume of liquid matter that had been in there had forced out all the air from the space, and with only a small manhole at the top, there had been no replenishing of the normal air with its normal amount of oxygen into that space. In an atmosphere totally devoid of oxygen, a man can live only a fraction of a second and then dies immediately. These men had died such a death, painless, but awful and sad nonetheless. The following Saturday, there were three funerals in Norton, two at the Enfield Funeral Home and one at the Methodist Church. Pretty much everybody in the county attended all of them, and pretty much the same things were said at each of them. Pretty much the same songs were sung, including The Old Rugged Cross and Amazing Grace, and pretty much everybody cried. By the end of that day, there was not a tear left in my hometown of Norton, Kansas.
Well, what a horrifying, horrifying tragedy. And yet what a beautiful telling of it. I have to ask, this was in the mid-1970s, is that right?
Yes, that's correct.
Do you know why there were no alarms or monitoring equipment to let them know what was going on?
Greg, this was such an unusual incident. You know, it's well known there are other types of elevator accidents, such as elevator dust. Grain dust can ignite spontaneously and
see,
cause
I've heard
fires
of that throughout my life, but yeah. I've never heard of this.
Well, nobody in town had heard of it before, and of course everybody knows about it now. But first of all, it's an isolated community, way out in the little town out in nowhere practically. And everybody was very careful, like all, you know, farming and farm-related industries cause or are related to probably more accidents and serious injuries than almost anything short of war and those kinds of things. But it had just never been heard of before, and it just, wasn't something that anybody really thought about. So when this happened, of course, it's now becomes well known, but it just simply wasn't on anybody's radar screen.
And was this the same grain elevator company that your father had managed?
Yes, uh-huh.
Was he still living when this happened?
Oh, yes. In fact, he was there. He and his partner, as I mentioned, they went every day. And they had turned the management over to my dad's partner's son, who was my age, Don. We'd grown up together. And I had aspirations to... to leave Norton, and Don was quite happy to be there, so he took over the management of the elevator. So both his dad and my dad were there that day, and they're the ones that called for help from the volunteer fire department.
Wow. What would you like our audience to take from this story?
Well, several things, I think. One is that it kind of shows that we're sort of all in this together.
Amen.
We live in our own little worlds thinking that these kinds of things usually happen to somebody else or to some place far away. And here was a simple little town, a simple community, and on the great scheme of things, this incident was not very major in scale. It certainly, if it happens to you, it's 100%.
Right.
But we hear of tragedies going around the world, and 30 or 40 years ago as well. But when it strikes in your family or your home, it takes on a new meaning. And so the fact that something like this could come into a town that's pretty serene and pretty, as I said in my introduction, kind of a happy town, these things wake you up and lets everybody realize that disaster can strike at any moment. And we think when we go to work each morning or start our day expecting to come home that evening and to our loved ones or ourselves or to Wonder Dog Floyd. And in just an instant, that can change, and we don't.
Well, it's certainly a reminder to err on the side of doing that last kind deed, saying that last kind word, and not putting it off for another day, because we really don't know that another day or another hour will be here.
Amen to that. I agree completely.
Well, my friends, you are listening to my guest storyteller, Michael Schaefer, on our new Wednesday time of So What's Your Story? Only on KPFT 90.1 FM Houston, 89.5 in Galveston, and 90.9 for our friends in Huntsville. I am your host, Greg Audell, with Nicole Rocherlon at the control board. And Nicole, thanks to the hard work of our entire team and our outstanding guest storytellers, our audience has been growing and growing dramatically, and as a result, here we are at Wednesdays at 8 p.m. for an entire hour. It's really an exciting time for the show. All of us who work with it, I'm happy to say it's an exciting time for our audience members who we're hearing great things from, great ideas, guest ideas from. So we welcome our audience, both old and new. So, Nicole, what do you think of our new time and our expanded show length?
Well, I am so excited, and I'm so grateful that we have moved to a different spot with extended amount of time, because so many people say, oh, I'm in bed by 10 o'clock, and it's just like, what are you doing to sleep? So for those listeners who gave us that excuse, now you have none.
Well, and also so often I see the clock getting to 10:26 and I'm like, there's so much more, you know, I want to hear from this guest.
Yes.
You know, and so that is, I'm excited about.
I'm excited. And I'm excited for everyone that's participating, and all of those persons that were not able to tune in at 10 o'clock. We are here at 8 just
We
for
are
you.
Here. Nicole, in the last few years, you know, I think you're aware that Houston has become the country's mecca for great storytelling. It truly has, just as we've long been a mecca for writers. Will you share with our friends some of the amazing opportunities for storytellers in our diverse city?
Absolutely, Greg. To start, everyone needs to follow us on our Facebook page. Make sure you go share it, like us on your way out, give us comments. We want to know what you're thinking. And we also have clips of our lovely program on our very own YouTube channel. So check us out there. And also, all of our past shows are on the Houston Storytellers website at www.houstonstorytellers.org. They're one of our biggest supporters. So go to the radio tab and look for those past shows.
And that is every single one of our last shows.
Every single one. And we don't want to forget that the Guild also meet. They meet everybody on the fourth Tuesday of every month at Temple Emmanuel at 1500 Sunset. Also, don't forget our wonderful friends at the Moth. They're at Warehouse Live the second Tuesday of every month.
Well, let me say a couple things about the Moth. I am so proud that the reigning monthly champion of the Moth is our very own Warren Holloman. I started to say Earl Holloman. No, Warren told just a powerful, powerful story at the last Moth, and I really hope that in the near future he will share it with our listeners, because it's one of the most powerful Moth stories I've ever heard. And our previous guest, Alyssa Ladd, recently had her story told on the National Moth. It's over 600 stations, a million listeners. And that's why I say with confidence that we bring you the best storytellers in Houston and in the state of Texas, and I think in the whole country. And, you know, storytelling is becoming popular all over the country. A few weeks ago, I was in Taos, New Mexico, and I attended Taos Mesa Brewing's weekly storytelling evening hosted by Haley Harper. She's a host that does a wonderful job of pulling it together. And it was so much fun to see how others are sharing their community stories. The evening was unique because it was kind of a mix of storytelling and people reading selections of their own writings. And I had never seen those two formats combine. But when you're traveling, check out the storytelling community evenings along your journey. It's a great way to meet locals, learn about the community you're in, and to hear stories you're not going to hear anywhere else. And maybe, maybe you'll even get up the nerve to share one of your own, as I did when I was in Taos. And Lisa, are you with us?
I'm here.
Well, you started out as a guest on our show and soon found yourself working with us as a full-fledged team member.
I did.
What has the experience been like for you working at KPFT?
You know, this was such a great program to be a part of. Once I joined and was able to share my own story, I had to be a part of this. I want to figure out every little nook and cranny of how to create the great stories that I hear.
It's really interesting, isn't it?
It is.
There's
fantastic.
So much more to it than you think there is.
Absolutely.
So you're going to be with us for a while?
I hope so.
I hope so, too. And tell me, what do you want to do? What do you want to do long term? Do you see radio being a part of your future?
Yeah, I definitely see that. And I would love to listen and create and have as many people telling stories as possible. I love the diversity that you guys have on the show. That's a part of what, you know, makes people want to listen every week.
And, you know, it's funny, Lisa's example was much like mine. I think we both came in here a little bit starry-eyed as guests and thinking, wow, I can't believe I'm going to be on a radio show. But like Lisa said, you start looking at everything, the clocks, the microphones, the computers, the interesting people around here, and you think, I'd like to be a part of this.
Yeah.
And you get sucked into KPFT, and it just doesn't let go of you.
That's right.
But if you're listening to this and you think it would be interesting to check out and see what it's like, KPFT behind the scenes, our pledge drive is starting tomorrow, and we are always eager to have volunteers come in, help us answer the phones. There's usually pretty good food here if you need an enticement. But it's fun. Once you step in KPFT, it's rarely your only time in the building. And I would say the same thing for Michael.
Absolutely. It's the way I started.
I'd also like to say about the Storytelling Guild, it is holding its annual Liars Contest. Now, this is true. I'm not lying. On Saturday, April 9th. And you will hear some of the best storytellers hearing some of the best lies. And information will be on our Facebook page and at HoustonStorytellers.org. You know, and I want to say that I speak for all of the hosts, for Warren, Hank, Mary, and myself, when I say that we could not do this show and keep it at the level that we expect it to be and that the station expects it to be without the incredible work of our behind-the-scenes team that you're getting to know now. And that's why we bring them on air. We want you to know the people that put this show together, both on air and behind the scenes. And, you know, we couldn't do it without the incredible KPFT staff, the volunteers and sustaining members that make KPFT tick. And I want to thank everyone who makes So What's Your Story the powerhouse program that it is. Now, Michael, your next story takes place about the same time as your first story, but in very different places. I think it tells us a bit about why someone would go into pediatric plastic surgery, which to me seems like an extremely daunting profession, both because of skill and the emotion it must pull out of you. But would you be willing to share your second story with us?
Greg, I'd be happy to. And I say that because this story is really about somebody else. And I just happen to be a lucky player in this drama, a co-journeyer with this young woman. The story is about a young Greek girl, Konstantina Triantafylidis, who came into my life when she was about 7 years old. But the incident that started all of this happened when she was 22 months old. She lived with her mother and father and an older sister, a grandmother and a great-grandmother in Heraklion, Crete, Greece. And one day the mother was at work, the grandmother was outside in the yard, and the great-grandmother was sort of tending Dina, who was not quite 2 years old, and the kerosene heater tipped over, caught the rug on fire, the carpet, and then caught the great-grandmother's clothing on fire, and burned the house down. And the little girl was in one of those old-fashioned iron baby beds, which heated immediately, and her fingers became fused to the iron railings, and she couldn't get them off, and people couldn't get them off immediately. Anyway, she was badly burned on her hands and her face. The rest of her body was spared of the burn. The great-grandmother ultimately died from her injuries. And from that point on, Dina and her burn injuries became the focus of that family's life. They moved to Athens, and this child underwent, we think, 30 or 35 surgical procedures over the next 5 or 6 years in Athens. And they did the best they could with limited facilities and limited resources. But they were doing mostly little pinch grafts from spots on her body, trying to resurface the burned area on her face. And so finally they told the parents that that was all they could do. During this time, her father was working double shifts at a flour mill, carrying 100-pound feed sacks or flour sacks in and out of the mill for an 8-hour shift and then another 8-hour shift to help pay for this child's medical expenses. When they were told that nothing more could be done in Athens, the mother then went to all of the embassies in Athens, the foreign embassies, asking them, please, would they take her child to whatever country that was, respectively, perhaps they could do something more for her. These included the Russian embassy, the Romanian embassy, French, British. And none of them either would or could oblige her. She then took the little girl to bars around town and had the child dance on the bar top to raise some money to help them with their expenses for her medical care. Chicago, as you may or may not know, is the second largest Greek city in the world, second only after Athens, and is ahead of Salonika. There's a large Greek community there, and they finally got word of this little girl and her family. And there's a wonderful media guru, Bobby Papadimas was his name. He owned a TV and radio station. And he heard about Dina and her family and got the Greek community together, and they raised over $40,000, and with that money they brought Dina and her father to Chicago. For the first year it was just she and the father, and then about a year later the mother and the sister were able to come and join them. I had spent a year and a half in Greece in the Air Force. I was a partially trained general surgeon in the U.S. Air Force, and just loved my year and a half in Greece, and so maintained my contacts with the Greek community when I got back to Chicago. So through that contact and the fact that I was a new staff member on the Children's Memorial Hospital, the spokespeople for that Greek community got in touch with me and asked if I would be willing to see this girl and give them my opinion. And I also had an older, much more experienced senior partner who would be part of that for a while. So that became the starting point for us. We saw the girl and met initially her father. Unfortunately, he spoke a very limited English, and I was able to get along on the Greek that I'd learned during my time in Greece. So we had this wonderful relationship, an immediate rapport. Dina was exactly the same age as my older girl. They were born in March of 1969. So she was 7 when they came to the States. We actually did her first operation on her 8th birthday. And so from that time on, their family became very closely intermeshed with mine, and my kids played with Dina and her sister, her parents, and my wife, and I became good friends. Over the next 20 years then, I operated on this child probably, it's not quite sure, 35 or 40 times. Sometimes we would do two or three surgeries in quick succession. Other times we would spread them out, let things heal and settle down for 6 months or perhaps a year. In plastic surgery, the essence of really good healing and a good result is just being patient and allowing Mother Nature to help and take her time with the healing that must go on. One of the reasons I'm so happy to tell this story, and it has nothing to do with my part in it, this child had the most indomitable spirit, and her mother had the most indomitable drive to seek everything possible for this child. Never in any of our experiences did the child say no, she wasn't going to do that, she wasn't going to have another surgery. The mother was just always there. Michael, isn't there something more we can do? Michael, isn't there something more that I could do to help? So we kept going, and even when I was down, or when I felt that the procedure had been less than optimal, they buoyed me up and said, you know, Dr. Schaefer or the mother would say, Michael, that's all right. We'll have another chance. It's not going to be perfect every time. And so over the course of some years, we totally resurfaced her face, making it much more smooth and kind of divided up into segments. We resurfaced her entire forehead, both cheeks, the chin, the upper lip, reconstructed her nose, and then separated the fingers that had been mostly amputated from the second knuckle on out. So it's called the distal part of her fingers, that is toward the tip of all 10 of her, 8 of her fingers and 2 thumbs had been burned away or had been amputated surgically in the early stages. So while we were waiting for things to settle down and heal on the face, we were doing a little operation on the hands to separate some of the fingers so that we could make them more mobile, and they were made her hands more functional. She couldn't even hold her own eating utensils when we first met, when this first started. So the other little sidebar here is that during this period of time, my family was remodeling an old house in Chicago. And so her father would come over on the weekends when he was off from his regular job and help me do the heavy work, the heavy lifting at our home. And believe me, there was some really dirty, heavy work. But he was such a professional laborer. He had made a profession of just doing hard work. And he could make the toughest job look easy, the dirtiest job look, he would come away from it not getting dirty, doing a dirty job. And Stavros was just a wonderful guy, very trim and very fit, but he unfortunately developed heart disease and died when Dina was in high school. Well, in college, she did go away to school. Wonderful Greek man paid her way through a private high school in Chicago, in the suburb of Chicago, and then on through college. And so in the summertime, she would come and work for me in my office. And I thought, you know, I'm very generous in spirit with these sorts of things. But I have to confess, I thought, you know, she's really still, as much as we've done for her, she's pretty still deformed. And is this going to be good PR for me to have somebody looking this deformed in my plastic surgery office? Well, it took me about 2 seconds to get over that thought, because I thought, you know, with all the work that I've done for her, if she can't work in my office, if I can't have her be in my environment, who in the world is going to? And so, you know, I didn't dwell on that thought very long. She's a wonderful, wonderful young woman. So I think she was between her sophomore and junior, maybe junior and senior year in the summertime. I said, Dana, we have just a couple more things to do. And she said, well, Dr. Schaefer, what is that? I'm pretty happy. And I said, well, the fourth and fifth finger on your left hand are still sort of scarred together. I think we should separate them. You might want to put a ring on that fourth finger one day. And she just laughed. She said, "Oh, Dr. Schaefer, you're just being silly. That's never going to happen to me. Nobody would really want me." I said, "Dina, you're going to be wonderful for somebody someday." So she went back to school that year, and some months went by, and she called, and she said, "Well, Dr. Schaefer, it's happened. Christopher's asked me to marry him, and I have a ring on that finger." So I didn't say I told you so, but I said, "Dina, I am thrilled for you, because somehow I sensed that there would be somebody out there who would appreciate the value for what you are." And she said, "Well, that's exactly what he said. He said he could see past my scars and my deformities, and he just loves me the way I am." And then she said, "I have one other favor to ask of you, since you know my dad's died. The wedding's going to be next September. Will you walk down the aisle with me and give me away?"
Wow.
So when I got my voice back, kind of like right now, I said, "Sure, of course I would. There's nothing I would rather do." And so Ellen and I went to Lexington, Massachusetts that September and helped celebrate in what was one of the most wonderful celebrations of happiness and love and joy that we've ever been part of.
Wow, what a wonderful story, Michael. You have taken us on a roller coaster of emotions in a few minutes. I was tearing up thinking about that poor 22-month-old girl basically being burned alive, and then I was smiling from ear to ear as I pictured you walking that same young woman down the aisle and making a part for her in your community and your family and your office, and thinking about what it said about you as the type of doctor and type of man you are. And I'm not going to put you on the spot, so you don't have to answer that. It just does. What goes through your head? Now, I have the advantage of looking at your face, and I have an idea of what's going through your head. But tell our audience what goes through your head while you're telling this amazing story.
Well, I think the first thing that comes to mind is gratitude. I have been so fortunate to have been able to do in my professional life what I've done. I did something called craniofacial surgery much of my professional years, and I had the opportunity to work with many children, much like Dina, but not to the same extent of getting to be intimate friends with the family, and their deformities were much more of birth defect nature, not burns in origin. But I have been fortunate. I've been blessed to be able to do this sort of thing. And as I tell people who tell me this, you know, you just read a couple books and go to a weekend seminar and you can do what I did. But
I have a feeling that's not true.
But it was just such a treat to work with children and families like Dina and her family. I tell you, I came away the richer for every encounter like that I ever had.
Well, this story is so moving that we were not the first to feature it. The December 6th, 1999 issue of People magazine featured the story of you and Dina, along with pictures of you walking her down the aisle. And we will be sure to post those pictures to our Facebook page if any of our audience would like to check them out, because I've certainly been kind of glued to them as we've prepared this show. I keep calling Michael with questions because, you know, morning, noon, and night, I think of new aspects of this powerful story. Well, my friends, this is Greg Audell, and you are listening to So What's Your Story on KPFT 90.1 Houston with my guest, Michael Schaefer. And you can also hear us at 89.5 in Galveston and 91.9 for our friends in Huntsville. It's time for Tips for the Teller. A tip that will help you develop your storytelling skills and hopefully a whole lot more. My tip is for those who allow their fear of public speaking to paralyze them. Here's a thought. Don't memorize your story. When you do, at least this is true for me, you memorize words and you're not necessarily memorizing the message. So if you forget a word, well, you know what happens. Anxiety City. I used to do that. I used to memorize things, And doing it that way absolutely paralyzed me with fear. Now, apprehension is good, because if you weren't nervous at all, you wouldn't care. But terror is something totally different. So know your story or your speech or whatever information you're about to convey in front of your listeners and be genuinely interested in it. Know that you are sharing something that your audience probably doesn't know, but will enjoy hearing from you. Use just a few bullet points if you need some reminders, as opposed to reading or sounding as though you're reading. Imagine the responses from your audience when your story works. And believe me, I've known that feeling. Smiles, tears, emotions. It's a situation that's just too good to pass up. See those faces and gestures before you speak. Then make it happen. Be heard and have fun with it. If you have fun, your audience will have fun. Michael, with your strong and confident voice, you don't strike me as someone who's ever feared public speaking. Is that correct?
Oh, I'm ashamed to say that probably is correct, Greg.
Nicole, I recall that not long ago, your first day here, your eyes were huge as you took in the fact that you were really going to be working on a radio show. And if you don't mind me saying, I also remember something close to terror on your face as you were going over what we were going to have you say the first couple of times. But that's actually hard for me to believe now, but I did see it with my own eyes. But you've become this radio personality, celebrity host. What have you thought about this transition that you've gone through? How did you overcome your nerves?
Well, first and foremost, I have to give kudos to Dr. Rubicek for passing out volume to us in class to help us cope with his teaching styles. No, I'm just kidding. I'm just kidding. No, after the first couple of shows, I did take heed to the feedback that I was given. And one of those things that I did learn from Dr. Rubicek was go back to our biggest sponsor, which is the Houston Storytellers Guild, and start listening to our past shows.
Absolutely.
So I did do that. And also, I just pretended also, you know, I'm talking to my mom or my kids or my friends, and I'm just in a conversation and I am being myself. And I had to realize, you know what? I am so personable. So why not?
And, you know, I hate to give you a compliment on air, no less, but I'm telling you, the transition I have seen has been amazing in you. I just remember vividly you sitting there, you know, like, don't bother me, I'm reading this. And now you just couldn't be more comfortable on air.
I'm
and it's
very
been such a pleasure to see.
Thank you.
It truly is. And, you know, again, don't quote me on this, but I'm proud of you.
I will quote you on that.
I figured. It's probably going to be like right on our Facebook page, Greg Audell said.
Yes, Greg Audell said. You know, I do have to say, I'm still a little jealous of Floyd the Wonder Dog, but he gets more media attention than all of us.
Well, you know, he's certainly cuter than I am. I do notice that, though, that we get a lot more requests about Floyd than we do me, but that's okay. That's okay.
It's okay.
I have been incredibly blessed with wise, funny, thought-provoking, and thoroughly entertaining guest storytellers during my year and a half as co-host. And while some of our guests are just traveling through, some are dear friends like Michael, and others are family. And I want to wish my guest from December 29th, Peggy Russell, a very happy birthday from all of us at So What's Your Story.
Happy birthday, dear Peggy. Happy birthday to you.
And just for the record, that was not Greg. That was Nicole's beautiful voice coming over. Peggy has been a flutist with the Houston Ballet Orchestra for over 30 years and teaches flute at the University of Houston School of Fine Arts. On the show, she spoke about the challenges of being a single mother. For several years, before marrying our very own Dr. Hank Rubicek, Peggy was just that. She spoke movingly about the challenges, stresses, and uncertainties of being, in her words, the designated doer of everything. That phrase has become one that Nicole and I have taken to heart since we first heard it from Peggy. And that's not a fair position for anyone to be in. But millions of single mothers face that challenge each and every day. And Peggy, we thank you for sharing your powerful stories, and we treasure you as part of the So What's Your Story family. And I might add, we appreciate you being our number one fan, because I don't know anyone else who has listened to every single episode of So What's Your Story going back to the very beginning, almost a decade ago. Here's to a great year ahead, my friend. And, you know, Peggy's stories of the challenges of being the designated doer of everything made me think a great deal about the storyteller who had the most profound effect on me, on my outlook on the world, my vocations, my adventures. My mother, Maureen Robinson Audell, was the first reporter to let me tag along with her on stories. I was 5 years old and would play under the police chief's desk while he was interviewed about the criminals going on in Pearland, Texas. I sat mesmerized while my mother interviewed survivors of Galveston's great hurricane of 1900. Do you realize it was the single deadliest one-day event in U.S. history, killing between 8 and 12,000 people immediately? I was probably six, I'm guessing, but I clearly remember one woman sharing how her husband had tied her and their children to a tree to ride out the hurricane. Their home was completely destroyed, but the family survived. Now, can you imagine riding out a Category 4 hurricane with 150-mile winds while tied to a tree? That image has always stayed with me. As great as these adventures and experiences were, none were as great as watching my mother undertake the unexpected role of designated doer of everything, the phrase so aptly coined by Peggy Russell. When it became apparent that my father would not be able to participate in a normal family life, my mother made sure we still had full and fun lives. We took geology courses with my sister. She took them with us at Rice's Extension School when I think I was around 8 years old. We learned to roof our new house together when I was in junior high. My mother took me on a great adventure to the Hyatt Regency and Gillies with a poet and a missionary one exciting evening when I was, I think I was 11. But that's a story for another show. She taught us how to take life, what life gives you, and make the very most of it. She also taught us to share our stories. So I'd like to wish my favorite designated doer of everything and my favorite storyteller a very happy 80th birthday tomorrow. I owe you a delicious old-fashioned or two the next time I see you. Next week, Dr. Hank will host former NFL coach Max Bowman, who will share stories about the grit and determination that makes for the soul of a winner. Michael, I've got to ask, is there anyone else you want to send a shout-out to?
Oh, sure. I have a small but very meaningful
fan base. Bill and Peggy Riley, Bob and Betsy Phillips, Terry Schaefer, Lee Doggett, John Martin, Margaret and Ben Kitchen, and other members of our family, too numerous to mention, but they'll hear about this one day.
Now, I'm curious, do you know if Dina will be listening to this program?
It doesn't go to Boise, Idaho, does it?
It does on www.kpft.org.
Oh, I hadn't thought about it. I'm so untechy, I will tell her that.
All right. Well, I would love to hear.
Can I add to that? I'm sorry. Also, we are on Facebook Live, so she can go to our Facebook page and sure she likes us,
too. Hello to our Facebook friends.
Yes, and see the story there. She can replay it. She can repost it as well. So make sure you share that, Dina.
Yeah, I'm sure she's connected with all those connections, so I'll tell her that.
Now, in People Magazine, there's just this wonderful picture of you walking her down the aisle. Do you recall what you were thinking in that moment? You're both beaming.
Oh, I think I was as happy as I'd been at my own wedding. It was just such a wonderful feeling. And as I said a little while ago, the feeling of elation and just love and that whole thing, it truly was one of the most meaningful celebrations of a wedding that I've ever attended. And my thoughts then were how happy I was for her that her life and really just blossomed, and she was going to do well from then on.
Well, you know, it's ironic that we have a pledge drive starting tomorrow, because you and I first met at the pledge drive table. And that's, I love the pledge drive table, because you do meet so many interesting people from so many walks of life. So I'm just curious, as a relative newcomer to Houston, how did you discover KPFT? Why is it important to you?
Well, it was, I must confess, somewhat by accident. I'm a public radio fan from years and years in Chicago. That was my main source of information and entertainment. So I found the local Houston, the other public radio station, and the not far off the dial from 90.1. So I just by chance hit 90.1 one day and really came to like it. I came down here one day, and there was a young man sitting at the desk, and I gave him a little money, and he asked if I was in radio or broadcasting, and I said no, but I've kind of always thought about it. So that was kind of the beginning. He said, and then I met Dwayne. He said, well, come and do a answer phones for a pledge drive for us. It's a good way to start. So that's how it did start.
It really is. I tell people that I think all of Houston comes through the door at KPFT at one time or another. And, you know, because we have such diverse programming, if you're here for a few hours, you're going to see an incredibly diverse group of people. And they're all interesting because they all have something valuable to say if they're in our studios.
You know, what I find interesting is when you've listened to radio for so long and you know the voices and you kind of imagine what they look like. And then you see the people that go with the voices. It's a real treat. And that's really fun to put those things together.
Well, friends, I don't want you to have to wonder too much about what I look like. Basically, I look like Brad Pitt. So, you know, just have that image in your mind.
On a really good day. On a really good day.
Yeah, well, they're, for those not on Facebook Live, just picture Brad Pitt when you hear me talk. You are a natural storyteller. Who was the storyteller in your home growing up?
Well, that's a good question. You asked the guest last week that, and I grew up in kind of a funny. Nobody really told many stories. We were very serious. I suppose my grandmother on my father's side, if I were to pick somebody, was probably the one. She did the most recording of family events. She was a photographer way before her time, and she always labeled the photographs, which nobody else in my family did. But she had stories to go with things. But there were other friends in my hometown, other parents, who were just always telling a story. So that may be where I got part of it. But I've come from such a rich background of people just, you know, kind of living life as it comes and making a story out of something that somebody else might not even think there was a story there.
Well, I was also thinking, I know you were in a fraternity. You spent many late nights in hospitals and many hours in operating rooms, and you were in the military. My guess is each one of those added to your storytelling ability.
Well, I certainly have stories from each of those parts of my life. I have stories and friends that I have to kind of remember which phase of my life they've come from.
I can imagine. But the nice thing about you is you're still living so many adventures that you're still developing new stories. I mean, you're even, well, I don't know, if I would say that you're a sculptor.
Well, that may be giving me a little too much credit. If you're thinking about the horses I make, I just assemble them out of parts. I don't really.
Once again, you're not doing yourself justice. These horses are amazing.
Oh,
and they're made out
of
driftwood?
That's how I've started, yeah, out of driftwood. And I use other found materials and discarded stuff. One of my main missions is to try to keep as much stuff out of landfills and out of poor Mother Earth that I can to use them, repurpose them for a new art project of some kind.
Amen. Amen. That's a problem that I fear may not be focused on in the next 4 years on the federal level. So we have to do all we can on the local level and all we can in our own lives.
You're right. I try never to throw anything away, and to the consternation of those with whom I live most closely sometimes. But
a friend of mine mentioned to me one time that there was a very fine line between recycling and hoarding, and that I often crossed it.
That could be. I sort of weave back and forth along that line most every day.
Well, Michael, are you ready for Pledge Drive? Are you going to be volunteering with us again?
Oh, Greg, I am so sorry. I must tell you, Ellen and I are boarding a plane at 8:40 in the morning going back to Chicago.
Oh, wow.
So, and if you don't mind, I'll put a little plug. I am doing a one-man show for a private play reading group in Chicago this weekend.
Oh, tell our friends about this. I was really impressed by this and how long it's been going on.
This is such fun. This is our 35th year. We started in 1981, about 25 couples in Evanston, Illinois, just north of Chicago, got together and started this play reading group. And the idea is that we read from a script. We meet one Sunday, the last Sunday of the month, 10 times a year. One couple is the host. They provide the food, the venue for this play, food and drink. Another couple picks the play, picks the cast, and then we have one practice session on a Sunday afternoon. And so it's been going on now, 10 plays a year for 35 years. And it is just, it's wonderful. The quality of the performance has just picked up so amazingly.
Well, I think it's incredible that y'all have kept this up for so long and that, you know, you're flying back for it. And now you've got a one-man show?
I am. I'm doing a play called Marcinkus.
Now, do you have to be off book or are you able to read it?
Well, in contrast to your advice not to memorize what you're going to do, I've been working on this. I've had this play in my possession for a few weeks now, and I have it pretty well memorized. But I will have a little cheat sheet to show you how techie I've gotten. I'm going to cheat from my iPad and not from a written paper.
You didn't have that in 1881.
I know. It's so unlike me. People are not going to believe it. But I have it mostly memorized.
You know, friends, you know, since Michael started telling me about this, I've kind of been asking around and talking to friends in the storytelling writers community, and I'm not aware of any such organization doing this in Houston. If you do, I'd appreciate you sending us a note on the Facebook page because I think it's just a great idea. And if there's not one, maybe you need to be the one to start it with your friends because, you know, I just think it's a great idea and it sounds like a whole lot of fun.
Oh, it's been a great fun, and this group has stayed together. They've become the core of most of our serious friends over the last 25 or 30 years. It's a very cohesive group, and we've been together through marriages and divorces and funerals and deaths and now more play reading.
Well, Michael, we may ask you to start at something like that in Houston. I want to thank you, Michael Schaefer, for sharing your stories, your insights, and your life experiences with us
tonight. It's my great pleasure, Greg. Thank you very much for inviting me.
It's been a total delight. And Brian and Jason are next with To Tell the World, another class act on KPFT. Please make 90.1 a part of every day, and while you're driving home, need a break from the day or turning in for the night, or if you're just chilling out, join us every single Wednesday at 8 p.m. for So What's Your Story? And treasure what you hear. If you keep loving a great story, we will keep bringing them to you. Above all, be actively good to each other. Mary, Warren, Hank, Nicole, Alondra, Lisa, and Floyd the Wonder Dog and I will forever be reminding you that it is never too late to live happily ever after, my friends. Peace.
For 95 years, San Jose Clinic has been an essential part of Houston, providing a health home to those who would otherwise go without care. Join them on Saturday, April 22nd to celebrate 10 years of art, jewelry, and generosity at Art with Heart 2017, a fundraising auction. In addition to recognizing Larry Massey with the Portrait of Compassion, the evening will include cocktails, plentiful hors d'oeuvres, silent auctions of art and jewelry, and a big board auction. Get your tickets today at www.sanjoseclinic.org/artwithheart. KPFT Houston.
Thank you.
Join comedian Cheech Marin as he discusses his life, touring with Tommy Chung, the world of Chicano art, and dancing with Kate Middleton at River Oaks Theater on Thursday, April 6th at 7 p.m. This ticketed author talk and book signing event is hosted by Brazos Bookstore and supported by H-Town Muse, Hawes Hill Calderon, and the Orange Show Center for Visionary Arts. Tickets must be purchased at least 24 hours in advance by calling Brazos Bookstore at 713-523-0701 or by visiting brazosbookstore.com. Details about Cheech and his memoir can be found at cheechmarin.com/memoir. Hit it, Cheech.
KPFT Houston. Yeah.
Hello and welcome to Tell the World on 90.1 KPFT. My name is Brian.
My name is Jason.
And thank you for joining us for the next hour. We have a fun show. I like to say big show, but then Jason rolls his eyes at me, but we do have a show.
It'll be 1 hour and 1 minute.
But yes, we have a lot to go over, but what we're going to predominantly focus on in sort of the first part of this show is going to be the new budget that was submitted by the White House to Congress. And it's kind of a doozy, and it's really important to talk about. I thought you had like a Star Wars reference you were going to make, and so I...
Oh, no, that was just for us. I wasn't going to say that.
Oh.
That was just a joke for you.
Oh, okay. I thought, well, you know, what is it in the prequels?
I didn't warm up my Emperor Palpatine voice.
Oh.
But I was, I was just kind of joking around and pulled some of the text from the crawl.
I take you way too literally before the show.
Yeah, you do, actually. I ran into traffic. I got here. You apologized for the traffic. I was confused as to why. Brian's just a strange person.
Yeah, I kind of am. Well, the big congressional focus right now has been over the health care plan. And we do have some really, I think, interesting news and, quite frankly, weird news regarding the Republican effort to repeal the Affordable Care Act. But for now, we're going to talk about this budget, mostly because it will probably pass. Republicans control the committees it would need to go through. They have the votes and seemingly also have the support. So this is important because, frankly, this specific budget is going to affect millions of Americans. So first up, the crux of this budget is a $54 billion increase to military spending. Now, the White House argued this week that our military is at an all-time low. That's how they put it. And in terms of power and capability, it's just bad, is how they were describing it, and that we need to dramatically increase spending. I mean, that really isn't true, since our spending is equal to what we spent in 2007, back when we had tens of thousands of troops in Iraq and Afghanistan. Interesting to note, though, the increased spending is specifically earmarked for two things. The $54 billion is said to be for increasing the amount of troops and for buying weapons and equipment from private companies. So that is kind of an interesting point, is that, I mean, this is kind of... the budget doesn't say how much goes to one side or the other. It doesn't say how much of the budget is going to be for increasing troop amounts. It doesn't say how much the budget is going to be for buying equipment from private companies. It just says that's what it's going to be earmarked for.
Yeah, and this is sort of like another chapter in the security theater that we've seen from the Trump administration. Yeah. We're not really like focused on security concerns. And I heard this, someone else say this, so I love the term security theater. That's all it is, security theater. Consistently say things that sound really good, that and say safe and say great, but they're not effectively, we don't really know what they're doing.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think it's kind of interesting that the way that it earmarks the money doesn't specify which way, you know, what proportion of that $54 billion is going to go. It doesn't say if it's going to be predominantly for increasing troop amounts, which I think is kind of this really interesting point to make, is that if you're talking about increasing the amount of troops that we're going to send abroad, that we're going to send into combat, I mean, that's kind of this really indirect way of announcing it in a budget. without actually talking about it or making any kind of announcement.
Right. Yeah. Where are these troops going?
Yeah.
Oh, maybe that thing about getting the oil.
Yeah. Oh. Oh, yeah, maybe. So in order to offset this $54 billion increase to military spending, there are a great deal of programs being cut or entirely eliminated. Now, first off is the Pre-Disaster Mitigation Program, which will be cut entirely. Now, this program, run by the Federal Emergency Management Agency, gives money to state and local communities to reduce risks before future disasters. It's sort of how, like, it's the reverse of how FEMA works. The budget of the agency is less than $1 billion, and the CBO estimates that for every $1 the government spent in this program, it saved $4 in disaster costs later down the line. Now, by the way, Houston, we have received several $1 million from this fund to help expand drainage, while Galveston also uses that money to upkeep the seawall. And weirdly enough, both of our cities use this fund to prevent terrorist attacks at our ports and at our transportation ports.
Right, yeah. Two big things that the Trump administration has continually talked about. I mean, from the time of the election, infrastructure, terrorism. Both. Yeah. I still have to George Bush when I say that. I'm sorry, terrorism.
That's fine. But, yeah. But I find it interesting that this specific fund is used for, you know, securing the ports and securing possible areas that could be targets of terrorist attacks. And then to say that, you know, he's going to be the law and order president and then, you know, get rid of this really important fund. Like, I realize that it's kind of tied to climate change. I think that's kind of the idea, is that it's tied to things that prevent climate change, or not really prevent, but combat the effects of climate change within communities.
Mm-hmm.
And so I can understand the idea behind why they want to do it, but the justification side, the actually public side of it, doesn't make any sense.
Oh my gosh, we haven't even gotten to the EPA yet.
Oh, we'll get there. Well, another program to be eliminated is the Community Development Block Grant, which funds a variety of projects related to community services. Now, the biggest hit would be that this would entirely eliminate Meals on Wheels, which is a program dedicated to providing food to elderly and disabled individuals. Now, a long string of studies indicates that Meals on Wheels and similar programs, it increases nutritional intake, it reduces loneliness, and is overall one of the most beneficial social services in our country. Despite these studies, the White House declared this week that Meals on Wheels is, quote, ineffective and that it doesn't work.
I would really like to know what the litmus test is for Meals on Wheels. Like, are there meals being transported to people that are hungry? Yes. That seems like it works. What is the return they're looking for exactly here?
Well, it isn't so much returns as they're trying to make justifications without really making, I think, factual justifications.
Right.
So, I mean, they state something as being what they say is going to be a fact. You know, so in their explanation, it's factual that Meals on Wheels doesn't work. In reality, you know, outside of that claim, the facts, the real facts just don't line up. And so I think, in a way, by making these arguments that aren't real and by spreading just false information, it adds to, I think, an overwhelming sense of noise.
Yeah.
So people who want to look into this and they want to find out, oh, is Meals on Wheels effective? They're not going to see the dozens of studies that have been done on Meals on Wheels. They're going to see White House says Meals on Wheels ineffective.
I think what the White House needs to do in this instance is really define what it means by what to them is Meals on Wheels working or being effective. How do they define working? Because, I mean, it works. It feeds old people. That's all it does.
Yeah.
It works. So really, really an upsetting cut.
Well, the Community Development Block Grant, which funds Meals on Wheels, nationally, the funds were spent, one-third of it's for public infrastructure, another fourth is for housing, and then you have administrative planning, public services, economic development, property acquisition. Funds may be used for community development activities such as like real estate acquisition and relocation, demolishing things. You have a lot of old buildings that just there's no money in the local areas to bring them down.
Mm.
There's also rehabilitating housing and commercial properties. It also improves things such as like water and sewer and utilities, street paving and sidewalks. It does a whole lot. Like it's a fund that we've had around since Nixon, and it does a lot of really good and important things, and it's being cut for these really arbitrary reasons by saying, oh, these are ineffective tools, when, I mean, the actual hard evidence isn't there with them.
So the budget proposal also wants to cut, I'm sorry, the budget also proposes cutting all programs related to climate change. The budget cuts the EPA's budget by 31%, that's one-third, and eliminates more than 50 programs. Other climate-related programs within the Department of Energy also are cut, including funding for international climate funds. Now, these cuts also mean that the U.S. will not meet its goal on the Paris Climate Change Agreement. The proposal would eliminate 3,200 EPA employees, or nearly 20% of the current workforce of the EPA. And this is something that I don't think is going to fly in the final version of the budget, because we really were at a point where recognizing the effects of climate change is becoming more bipartisan. So cutting this, you know, cutting the EPA by a third is really dramatic.
I know what you're saying is that there has been, I think, a broader acceptance of climate change. You do have sort of the John McCain wing who are saying, yeah, no, this is definitely real. Mm. And you do also have Rex Tillerson, who, at least in his fake email accounts or his email accounts with a different name, talked about how real climate change is and the effects that it's having. But I think that in terms of enemies, I think that the EPA has been this constant target for Republicans, at least with the much more far-right Republicans. And so they see it as this organization that impugns on people and you know, kicks them off their land or charges oil companies when they do oil spills.
Well, some of the EPA programs being cut would be their Research and Development Department, the Energy Star program, which if you ever look on your appliances, you see Energy Star. That's what that is. Infrastructure assistant programs, a grant program that helps cities and states combat air pollution, and an office that focuses on environmental justice issues. Funding for the massive Chesapeake Bay cleanup project, which receives $73 million per year, would be cut to zero. Similar cleanup programs in the Great Lakes and around the country would be cut to zero, forcing local residents to pay for the cleanup. Here in Harris County, there's an old waste and water treatment center that contaminated an area in Pasadena. That site is still being cleaned up using these funds, as well as three other sites around the county.
Yeah, I mean, the idea of this is the way that functionally we clean up sites, whether it's, you know, an oil spill or it's an old factory that's leaking all kinds of contaminants. This program has been used for, I think when I was looking into it, about 50 years in sort of a way to relieve the pressure off of local communities that are affected by, you know, essentially companies that dump their waste or don't have proper cleanups. And so even here in Harris County, we have, there are actually four sites in Harris County where we are currently using those funds to clean up. And the toxic chemicals that the EPA has listed as being here in Harris County, it's some serious stuff. And we don't have, I think, the capabilities or the capacities or the equipment needed to actually do that cleanup on our own.
Well, it also makes it harder in a city like Houston where we don't have zoning laws. A lot of those places where they call them Superfund sites. A lot of these Superfund sites are now places where they are very close by residential areas, just because Houston doesn't really have zoning laws. There's kind of a little bit of everything everywhere, and that's a big part of the problem with those sites here.
Yeah, I mean, also to kind of think about is the fact that if, as a community, Harris County is going to have a problem with this, if this budget passes and we no longer get the Superfund, you know, Harris County, we might be able to deal with it because we're a rich city. If you go to more rural areas where Superfund sites are much more prolific, much more active, they're not going to have that ability. They're not going to have that capacity. So it's a really weird position to be in, because then you end up ultimately hurting. I mean, Trump ultimately ends up hurting his own voters. And so, I mean, that's kind of this reoccurring thing that we've been seeing, at least through the healthcare bill, but now we're seeing it appear in this budget.
Well, and also in this budget, to that point, you know, a lot of these, the most rural areas, some of the poorest areas in the Appalachians that absolutely voted for Donald Trump, are not going to be benefited by any sort of job creation in this budget. And that was a big thing for him, and that was a big reason why a lot of those people in the Rust Belt and in the East and the Appalachians voted for Donald Trump, was to bring back jobs. You've got some defense spending to private companies, that sort of thing, but nothing that's going to bring jobs back to the sort of people that voted for him, to those sort of areas. This is, you know, just another kind of rich corporations getting richer kind of budget so far.
Well, one really bizarre cut is a 13% cut from the Transportation Department. Now, this is because the budget proposes to completely privatize air traffic control and have the responsibility go to just one company. The transportation budget also eliminates funding for rail expansion for use of public transportation. So they'll still have rail expansion for oil trains, I believe is how the budget states it, but no more rail expansion for public use. The only thing I can really think of as to why they want to do this is because of Republican Bill Shuster. He's the chairman of the House Transportation and Infrastructure Committee. He's had this as a longstanding goal to privatize air traffic control and privatize rail systems. Mostly because I think almost 95% of his campaign donations come from groups that want to privatize air traffic control and public transportation. So you do have that very obvious, oh, that's why you want to get rid of the social service.
Right. I mean, it makes me uncomfortable because, you know, you see situations where oil and gas companies will have a pipeline, like what happened in California. I'm going to be very vague because I didn't look this up. I don't have the details in front of me. But basically, a pipeline that ran under a neighborhood exploded and hurt a bunch of people. And the company, you know, had to pay some fines or whatever. Nobody was really held liable. No individual people went to jail over this, and people died. And so, you know, when you get to the point where you're handing over something as important as air traffic control, public transportation, especially talking about these trains that carry oil, that carry crude, it's dangerous. And who do you hold accountable when something happens? If you can't hold government employees and everything's documented and everything, you're talking about private companies. It sounds risky to me.
But private incentives, the sort of profit motivation of air traffic controlling.
Yeah, we need flights to get more expensive. I mean, ultimately going to come down to
that. Yeah, that is ultimately what that means. And we would be the only country in the developed society that would have this. Mm. And so it's kind of like this weird, oh, you want to do this thing that no one else has really tried and try to think that it's going to be successful.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. It's very weird. You have getting rid of public transportation again as this other reoccurring thing that we see throughout the Trump administration, throughout this White House. Then that ultimately hurts job growth, like you said earlier.
Right. And this budget also makes major cuts to education, shifts money over to private school funding. This education budget also eliminates before and after school programs as well as summer programs. There's also work-study programs that would be entirely eliminated. The Federal Supplemental Educational Opportunity Grant, which is reserved for college students with the greatest need for financial aid, would also be eliminated.
Yeah, I mean, this is another, I think, you know, going towards more fringe conservative ideals in terms of privatizing school, privatizing higher education. But then you also have these weird, you know, no more before and after school programs, which are highly beneficial and highly useful, and just having them completely eliminated. It's another thing where, who is this going to affect the most?
Yeah. Well, you know, that's happening on the federal level. Here in Texas, you know, we just failed to expand pre-K funding. So,
yeah.
You know, screw the children. Sorry, kids.
Well, by the way, if private schools do get this national funding, you can expect lawsuits because it would be a violation of church and state in a lot of these cases. The way that the current system works is it's this weird kind of sidestepping where the funds indirectly, where public funds indirectly go to private religious schools. With what this budget is proposing, it's direct money to private schools. So,
yeah.
I mean, this is something that some states have done. They've been sued, and this is sort of a way of doing it on a national level. And no doubt you will see lawsuits result because of this. And I will also be really interested to see what will happen when non-Christian schools, you know, schools that aren't Christian but are still religious, when they start getting funding. And I wonder how that's going to really play out, because it's going to be the states that end up deciding, according to this budget at least, who gets the education money.
You know, we talked about not long ago, there is a school in Houston, I think in the Heights. It's a multi-language school that offers teaching in Arabic, that has a lot of Muslim students, because we know that we have a lot of immigrants that come into Houston, a lot of refugees in a lot of cases as well. And just because people at that school spoke a different language and whatnot, there were protests outside that school in Houston.
Yeah.
So, I mean, yeah, having schools that absolutely, you know, are private institutions that are Jewish schools, Muslim schools, you know, whatever the case may be, there's absolutely going to be terrible, terrible, heartless protests outside of them.
Yeah.
I mean, that is a guarantee. I'm sorry.
Well, the proposal would also eliminate funding for nearly 20 smaller independent agencies, including the National Endowment for the Arts, the National Endowment for Humanities, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and the Legal Services Corporation, which finances legal aid groups.
Yeah, we don't need before school, after school, pre-K, or Sesame Street. We don't need any of that. It didn't help anybody.
Well, I mean, it's also, I mean, this is funding that goes towards, you know, preserving the Constitution, or, you know, going to go see, you want to go see the Bill of Rights, or you know, go to any kind of national monument.
Yeah.
Like, this is where that funding comes from. It comes from these federal programs.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think what this budget is trying to do is then privatize those things. So if you want to go actually see the Constitution in person, you better be willing to fork over $20.
Yeah.
I mean, that's kind of what this is privatizing much of what I think historically makes us good.
A lot of things are going to be okay, even with the, you know, the hit to Endowment for the Arts funding. You know, like radio stations like a Houston Public Media, like NPR, would be fine. They make plenty of money outside of government funding anyways.
But NPR stations that aren't in large metropolitan areas will not do as well.
That's true. That's true. Even though, you know, probably a lot of those rural areas that voted for Trump are already tuned into Sean Hannity anyways.
True. Yeah. He's my boyfriend, so
I know.
Watch it.
I know. I'm sorry.
Well, the budget also includes additional money to build Trump's promised physical wall along the U.S.-Mexico border. Now, this represents a genuinely new investment, and it doesn't come cheap. Estimates for the total cost range from $14 billion to $50 billion. The $50 billion number is actually said to be the more accurate one because of all the problems that will no doubt happen when it comes to going through various terrain and... So the $50 billion number is kind of what I think is the more factual one,
mm-hmm.
while the $14 billion is the low one that Republicans put out saying, no, this is what it's probably going to be. Probably not going to be that. So the southern border is already patrolled by federal immigration officials and drones, and there are fences at certain high-risk sections, and net immigration from Mexico is actually negative,
mm-hmm.
which means that there are more Mexican-American or Mexicans that are leaving the United States than there are coming in. So it's kind of weird that we want that they want to really fund this project. Well, it's not weird that they want to fund this project. We knew that they wanted to fund this project.
Yeah, and it's not as though that statistic is purely driven by people being deported. People are simply not trying to cross as much because of what's going on.
Yeah. Also, on an interesting note, the budget also eliminates a reimbursement program for states for when they detain undocumented immigrants. So now the cost of following Trump's executive order to essentially turn, you know, all law enforcement into border security will now have states, they'll no longer be reimbursed for that cost of holding them.
Hmm.
So there you go. Good policy, right?
Also, overall, all the programs listed and cuts that have been made will be equivalent to the projected cost for the border wall. So essentially, we're eliminating all these beneficial programs so that Trump can have his border wall that we are going to pay for. Because that $14 to $50 billion is U.S. dollars, not pesos.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, this budget does confirm that we are going to pay for the wall. It's not going to be Mexico, so that's a broken promise. But it's also the point here is that with all these cuts, it equals to about $50 billion. Now, they don't specifically list it in the budget. They don't give you conclusions. They don't give you totals. And so you kind of have to do it yourself and then make little adjustments. So the totals that I've looked at, you know, NPR says one thing and Fox News makes it, you know, they call it the skinny budget, you know, wink, wink. But no, I mean, if you do the math out and you look at this by, you know, you're cutting after school programs, you're cutting the EPA, you're cutting... public transportation, you're cutting air traffic control, you're cutting research and development, you're cutting climate change programs, you're cutting what else do we have? I mean, all these things, the FEMA pre-disaster mitigation program,
mm-hmm.
all these things are getting cut so that Trump can have his wall. And so that's the point here, is that when you do the math out and you're getting rid of these great social programs, it's because Trump wants to have his wall.
The nice thing about this budget, and let me just make sure for people that don't understand the process. This is not final. This isn't even close. This is the White House's proposal to Congress. Congress can look at this thing and go, hey, you're nuts. No. And do something completely different. And that would happen. And Trump would ultimately sign it because usually the president doesn't want the government to shut down. I don't know. Trump's a weird guy. But, you know, this is really the budget that I expected from him. I expected this sort of, I'm a businessman. I'm going to focus on the two things that are the most important. And I'm going to cut everything else. And so to me, this isn't really a surprising budget. I'm going to be curious to see how much of it gets out intact, especially considering what you just said about the wall funding.
Yeah.
If Republicans are also serious about the wall, they are going to want to get that money from somewhere.
Yeah. Well, that's where they're going to get it from. Now, sort of interesting postscript to all this. These budget cuts are really severe and seem to, you know, really only benefit rich people and private companies that the military uses to order equipment from. And so what's really interesting is that we learned this week that the White House had issued what is effectively a gag order on all cabinet members and White House staff when it comes to discussing this budget. Essentially what Jason just said, what happens is when a budget has to move through various committees, and that's where, you know, they'll typically cabinet heads and agency officials testify before these committees and talk about the budget, and they try to justify it and argue for it. Well, the White House has ordered everyone to just say no. No to testifying before any committees. They don't want people talking about this. And since those committees are run by Republicans, it's not likely that they will compel any of the cabinet members to even show up.
Yeah, we'll see. I'm not sure about that one. I think that there are a lot of Republicans in Congress that will be interested in keeping the funding for the things that they've kind of been in charge of.
Yeah.
And not, you know, defunding themselves off of a committee or out of a job. But we'll see. It's been weirdness on Capitol Hill, especially with them, you know, all the arm twisting going on with the Trump administration and the health care bill.
Yeah.
And, well, more on that later. But...
Well, more on that now.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Well, we said earlier that we had some weird news about the health care bill.
I just said it, I guess. Whoops.
Yeah. Well, I meant like earlier.
Oh, yeah.
But this is fascinating. So according to the Congressional Budget Office, the Republican bill to replace the Affordable Care Act would actually result in more people being uninsured than if, you know, Obamacare were simply repealed. What?
No, that's really stupid.
I thought you saw me bobble my
head. No, I mean they're not even repealing it, and if they would do just a clean repeal, just erase Obamacare, just whoop, scrub it away, it would be better than what they're doing. That's crazy.
So according to the Congressional Budget Office, getting rid of the major coverage provisions and regulations of the ACA would cost 23 million Americans their health insurance, as compared to the 24 million who would lose coverage under the Republican plan. So in other words, 1 million more Americans would have health insurance with a clean repeal than with the Republican replacement plan. And while the general thought in the media is that the Republican plan is dead, well, this week we learned of some changes that were made in order to specifically convince certain Republicans to vote for it. Now, there were quite a few tweaks. There were more tax breaks included for the wealthy, more punishment for the poor, like requirements for Medicaid, or work requirements for Medicaid, rather, and a weird anti-abortion provision. But these regional provisions targeted at specific GOP lawmakers were introduced. Specifically, Republicans looked at congressional Republicans who openly opposed the bill and then chose their districts to be exempt from Medicaid costs. So, you know, it's, you know, like, vote for the bill and your district won't have to pay for Medicaid anymore. Everyone else will.
Hmm.
There's also a rumor that a vote will happen tomorrow in the House, apparently for symbolic reasons, because March 23rd is the anniversary of President Obama signing the ACA way back in 2010. So this could have a vote tomorrow. They definitely tried to sweeten the pot, I think, and tried to convince the Republicans who are holding out and saying that this is a bad idea. Every estimate that we've seen so far, it is worse than just repealing the Affordable Care Act. You end up with a lot less people insured. You end up with a lot more costs and fees and fines. I can't imagine that this will be a good policy if it were to ever pass. But yeah, we'll see tomorrow.
Yeah,
maybe.
I mean, you know, you also heard some of you know, this is funny because it kind of goes hand in hand with what Trump, the administration, was basically saying. to Republicans, which was, hey, you better pass this or you're not going to have a job, which wasn't really like a threat so much as a self-fulfilling prophecy, I guess, because they would get voted out probably. But, you know, putting this now, this exemption from Medicaid costs in there, that, yeah, that really sweetens the pot, especially in light of saying that.
Well, I mean, it'll make the districts where they, you know, they're voted from be like, oh, how great, you saved us a lot of money in Medicaid costs.
Yeah.
So, I mean, we'll see. Also, the new anti-abortion measure that they put in to kind of, I guess, get some of the anti-abortion people.
Oh, yeah.
It deletes a provision that allows people to transfer unused tax credits into a health savings account, because apparently some Republicans were afraid that this might indirectly allow tax credits to be used for abortions.
Hmm.
But I mean, like, that's just kind of...
We should just stop paying lawmakers, because some of that money may be accidentally, indirectly used to pay hookers and prostitutes and buy drugs. I mean, we just don't know.
Well, I mean, we have seen several instances of what you're talking about, but I won't, you know, get knowledge.
I think that's enough to cut funding. That's got to be, I mean, that's the Republican playbook right there.
All right, well, let's move on to the Senate confirmation hearing of Judge Neil Gorsuch. Now, a lot has been happening that's eclipsed the ongoing hearings for Judge Neil Gorsuch, the Russian scandal with the Trump campaign predominantly being the main headline, and we are going to kind of get to that later. Some of the key takeaways from the Neil Gorsuch hearing, though, is that he refused to answer whether or not President Trump's business dealings poses a conflict of interest or even violates the Emoluments Clause. Gorsuch also deflected questions related to his past defense of the use of torture. During the Bush administration, Gorsuch argued that torture somehow prevented terrorist attacks. When asked today for that evidence, Gorsuch deflected that question. So it's kind of a weird situation with that. So back in 2016, July of 2016, Hillary Clinton made an announcement that was kind of politically shocking. She said that should she become president, that she would not continue the nomination of Judge Garland, who was President Obama's moderate choice for the court, and instead she would choose what she called, quote, a true progressive to take the seat. And for that entire week, Republicans like Lindsey Graham, Mitch McConnell, Paul Ryan, and even Trump himself all said that Clinton would never be able to fill a Supreme Court vacancy because she was under investigation by the FBI. And because of that FBI probe into Clinton's emails, she would therefore never be allowed to pick a Supreme Court justice. So that's what they said back in July of 2016. Well, now that Trump is officially under investigation by the FBI, have you heard Lindsey Graham, Mitch McConnell, Paul Ryan, or even Trump himself come out and say, you know what, I'm not allowed to do this. Because remember I said that she couldn't do it back in July, but, you know.
Yeah, well, now it's fake news now. It's not a real investigation, right?
I guess. Now, one thing to take note, Gorsuch has been very evasive with his questions or with his answers. When asked about things regarding gay rights, gun rights, abortion, he repeatedly kept saying it's law of the land. And those were in responses to, you know, how do you feel about those things? Would you overturn them? So in a lot of ways, it's been we don't really know where he stands on a lot of issues politically.
Yeah. And I don't think that's a problem. I don't think that's weird. Sotomayor was very similar in that regard, didn't want to address things that could possibly be court cases. Ruth Bader Ginsburg refused to comment on the death penalty because she felt that she may be voting on it very soon in the future. It's not uncommon for judges to try to avoid topics which they feel if they were confirmed they may have to soon judge, vote on, simply because it would, you know, it can affect the lower court rulings so as to avoid sending it to the Supreme Court if they give hints about how they're going to rule one way or the other. Now, I will say, you know, this entire situation is strange. You know, Neil Gorsuch shouldn't be confirmed just because it's a stolen pick. It should have been Merrick Garland, obviously.
Yeah.
However, it's a little hypocritical to say that when we also acknowledge that Hillary Clinton would have chosen someone else also anyways. So, whatever. That's kind of a wash. Don't know. I don't think Neil Gorsuch is... I don't think he's a bad guy. I think he's. He's judged in 2,700 something cases. One has maybe been reversed. I wasn't really sure. I was listening today, and they were joking about it, so I wasn't sure if it had actually been reversed when Lindsey Graham was talking to him at one point. But yeah, I don't know. I mean, you know, there's been a lot of political turmoil around this choice. You know, with Trump coming out and saying, "Well, I'm going to pick someone who will repeal this and that." Yeah. You know, when he was asked about Roe v. Wade, he basically said, you know, it's the law of the land, and a judge's first priority is to look at, you know, precedent and to look at how long something has been a law before you think about overturning it. So he seems like a pretty level-headed guy. I mean, this is the guy we've got. So if Trump was going to pick someone, this, you know.
Well, I mean, yeah, the other choices were pretty awful.
The other choices were pretty awful.
If you looked at the list, I mean, there was that one guy who wanted to recriminalize homosexuality.
Mm-hmm.
That was his whole dig.
Yeah.
But in terms of how I think procedurally to move forward, it is kind of odd how quickly Republicans are trying to get this through.
Yeah.
That's not really, it doesn't happen this fast. And so I think that kind of, it would be better if they pumped on the brakes and they said, all right, we're going to give you some time and we're going to work on this. We're not going to try to force a vote next week. We're going to try to convince you over some time and
right.
have multiple hearings. And that's really just not what's happening. It's just trying to be rammed through really quickly. And that's not going to be good for the Democrats, who are obviously upset about, you know, 300 days
mm-hmm.
of
nearly a year. It's one of those things that, as much as I would like to see some possible world where Democrats just, you know, refuse to confirm anybody, and yet what we're really talking about is killing the Supreme Court in that case, and it's really irresponsible.
No,
I think I think that just because Republicans didn't do their job does not automatically make it to where Democrats need to do this one-upmanship thing and not do their job.
But it's not necessarily one-upmanship. If you're talking about doing the same thing that they did to them, then it's just reciprocal. And if Republicans are setting this kind of precedent,
but
they're saying,
just because some kid throws mud at you doesn't mean you can go up and hit him in the face. Somebody has to be the responsible
party. That is a facile
party. Somebody
way to
has
look
to
at
be.
It.
No, not at all. We constantly criticize Republicans for doing this sort of thing, for doing government shutdowns, for not confirming judges, whatever. I don't want to see the people that my votes may have put into office doing the same damn thing. It's an irresponsible way to run a government.
Okay, it might be irresponsible in that regard, but if you're talking about Democrats just letting Republicans mow them over and not having a backbone, I think that's a big criticism, is that Democrats haven't had this backbone to stand up.
But I'm talking strictly about the Merrick Garland situation, because that has been mostly what Democrats have focused on in these hearings. You constantly hear them talking about Merrick Garland, whining about Merrick Garland. Yes, it sucked. Absolutely. Neil Gorsuch should not be the next Supreme Court justice. But that's where we are.
Yeah.
That's the reality of the situation.
I do think he will get confirmed.
I think so as well. Yeah. I think he's good. I think from what I've heard, he sounds like a good judge, generally speaking. His personal opinions, I mean, he's chosen by Trump. Anyone chosen by Trump is going to be conservative, because that's what he's going for. I don't know. I don't really see a huge problem with this guy.
All right, well, let's move on.
I really do enjoy listening to Al Franken talk to him, though. Al Franken is one of my favorite guys in there, by the way.
Well, the really big news this week was that the FBI confirmed that they are, in fact, investigating Trump's involvement in the Trump campaign with their ties to the Russian attack on our elections last year. The big takeaways here are, I guess, confirmation that there is an investigation into the Team Trump's involvement with Russian hacking. There was a no comment on whether or not Trump himself is being investigated, which I think is something that you shouldn't take a whole lot of stock into. There was also a flat-out denial of Trump's claims regarding the Obama administration's wiretapping of Trump's campaign. We also got confirmation that the FBI is assessing if criminal activity ever took place, which in this case would specifically mean acts of treason. So that is kind of an interesting development. I mean, the word treason, I think, is something that with the Hillary Clinton stuff got thrown around a whole lot. And with this, with the Hillary Clinton stuff, you know, it wasn't really treason so much as it was just negligence.
Mm-hmm.
With this, you're talking about actual collusion with a foreign government entity to disrupt our elections. And so now that we are getting that confirmation that, oh, yeah, I mean, we are looking into this and we are looking into the criminal aspects of it, that does kind of change the game entirely. Now, I was watching on Fox News. They said repeatedly throughout the day, well, if you missed the hearing with James Comey, you didn't miss much. Nothing really to see here. Nothing important. It doesn't mean anything.
I mean, in a way, it's true. I mean, it's not like he pulled out the smoking gun or anything. It's not like, you know, he laid out exactly which bank account Trump was receiving his Russian dollars in. So in that sense, I guess. Interestingly, a lot of Democrats have seized on this now to say that they should slow down and hold up the nomination or the vote of Neil Gorsuch because of the FBI investigation, because you wouldn't want a lifelong appointee appointed by someone who's guilty of treason.
Yeah, that's what Schumer was saying earlier. So it will be interesting to see how this kind of plays out in that regard. Those were the factual takeaways, I think. We also learned that the Republicans on the committee weren't really interested in whether or not the Trump campaign committed acts of treason, but rather why FBI officials were leaking things to the news media. Mm. So, like, all of their questions were predominantly about, well, are you going to try to stop these leaks? And and it's like, well, they're not, he didn't come here to talk about that, right? Yeah. He came here to talk about the Russian hacking of the election.
I wish Republicans, I guess, would just figure out which side they want to publicly say the FBI is on, because it's like, you know, Comey comes out right before the election and talks about Clinton's emails, and they love Comey, and Comey comes out after that and talks about Trump and the FBI, or Trump and Russia, and they hate Comey. Can we figure out Comey?
Well, right now we know that people who work for Trump during the campaign that also had contact with the Russian government include Carter Page, a foreign policy advisor, Paul Manafort, Mr. Trump's second campaign manager, Roger Stone, a political advisor, Michael Flynn, who was forced out as Mr. Trump's first national security advisor, Attorney General Jeff Sessions, Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross, Trump's son-in-law Jared Kushner, along with Trump Jr., who himself made public claims about meeting with Russians, only to later then deny that it ever happened, and about three other campaign staffers. So I guess, you know, at what point can you no longer deny some kind of relationship? If you had, I mean, you know, back when this campaign was starting, and you and I were kind of like looking over, oh, who can we try to contact so we can, you know, ask him questions and that kind of stuff. They had the tiniest operation out of all of the other candidates during the primaries, and then even going into the general election. So it is kind of, I think, hard to reconcile if they had this really thin staff, this really, you know, bare bones staff, compared to the Clinton campaign, who had, you know, hundreds and hundreds of staff. And it's hard to imagine that there wasn't ever, you know, a conversation that happened. So, you know, either it's this idea that Trump is, you know, a useful idiot, or he's, you know, knew. He at least knew something. On another note, we did get this weird press release from the White House. It really kind of doesn't make a lot of sense, but the official White House response, just to summarize here, is that Hillary Clinton was actually involved with the Russian hacking, or maybe actually Democrats are just making up all the claims about Russian hacking, which I guess also means that the White House is claiming that James Comey is lying. And that the wiretapping definitely happened, and evidence will soon be released. I think that they released this kind of wacky statement because Trump, he got all upset on Twitter, and then he kind of said, like, a variety of these things. And so I think they were trying to, like, you know, corroborate or back, you know, try to get him supported in some way with the weird things that he was saying on Twitter.
I really think if they could take one one kind of piece of advice, just tune in to Tell the World for just a minute, anyone in the Trump administration or cabinet, quit bringing up Hillary Clinton. I mean, it's over. Like, I understand that Donald Trump has had one political victory in his life, and that was becoming president, beating Hillary Clinton. That's it. Yeah. That's probably the only political victory he's going to have, given how many of his executive orders end up in court. You gotta quit waving that flag. It's getting kind
of
old.
But I think that's kind of how Trump has operated. He operated his campaign by having some kind of enemy, having an enemy of some kind that he can then put all his anger and put all his, I think, fire towards.
Russia's a good one. Russia'd be a good
enemy.
It would
be a good one.
Yeah, we've used them as an enemy for a long time. Works out great.
But I think that he doesn't really have a specific person that he can point to right now and try to rally around and say, that's someone that I do not like and they're doing bad things and they're, you know.
But I mean, how ridiculous is it that he's, you know, criticized the prime ministers of Australia, Angela Merkel, you know, several European leaders, several of our allies, and yet he still just can't quite bring himself to say anything about Russia, about Putin, about anything going on. Where are those tax returns, by the way? I want to see how much money he's getting from the Russian Federation. Anyways, we can move on.
All right. Well, Immigrations and Customs released the first list of immigrants who have allegedly committed crimes in the U.S. Now, this was supposedly going to be a weekly list, which was ordered by Trump to highlight the crimes that immigrants commit. It has now had its first full release on Monday, and it's kind of interesting. I didn't really know whether or not to talk about this, because the point of this list is to publicize crimes committed by immigrants. And so I thought, oh, no, I'm not going to, you know, promote that. But when you actually read it, it's fascinating. So the list specifically calls out police departments and counties that don't hold undocumented immigrants in permanent detention. Part of why that is because it is unconstitutional to hold someone once a judge has ordered their release. So the list just kind of whines and complains at counties that don't hold immigrants indefinitely, or counties that, you know, basically don't violate the Constitution. Now, Travis County, by the way, gets 12 full pages. So here's the thing that I think is most interesting. According to Trump's order, ICE was supposed to release things like names, last known addresses, family, and even photos if they were available. But the list by ICE doesn't contain any of that. It's just vague alleged crimes and the counties that don't detain immigrants indefinitely. Now, reportedly, the White House is very upset at ICE since they didn't actually, you know, include all that personal information. So I don't know. Maybe we'll find out by next week if ICE will actually fully comply with the White House's order or continue on a weekly basis just publishing vague alleged crimes. It's both. Either way, it's dumb. Like, yeah. Either way, it's bad.
I'm wondering if, you know, it took them so long to do because they were trying to, you know, find all this information. And I want to know over what time frame all this information comes from, if this is like months worth of arrests and releases, because it's going to make it really difficult to do a weekly list if they're only releasing, you know, 40 names a week or something like that across the, you know, that doesn't seem like a big deal.
I mean, it's a lot that they're releasing in terms of like the length, but it doesn't have, you know, any kind of specificity.
Right. There's not a lot of pertinent information. There's not a lot of important information.
It's just the way that it listed is that this county, they won't give us a person, and someone, you know, assaulted someone.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh, how informative.
Well, if you've been following recent ICE activities, then you definitely saw the raids that have been taking place around the country, especially in so-called sanctuary cities. Now, this week, it was revealed that ICE raids conducted earlier in Austin were targeted attacks as a response to the sheriff's new policy, which limited her department's cooperation with ICE. So this revelation came from U.S. Magistrate Judge Andrew Austin. Of course, his name is Austin, just to make this whole thing entirely confusing. This revelation conflicts with what ICE told local leaders after the sweep, which described the raids as routine, not at all targeted. The way the ICE agents conducted the operation, you know, officers pulling over people suspected of being in the country illegally or going to their homes and businesses to arrest them, was a substantial change from how the agency has operated in Travis County. In the past, most arrests were prompted by immigration checks on Travis County jail inmates. The operation, which led to the arrests of 51 people suspected of being in the country illegally, led some families to shelter in their homes for days, parents pulling their children out of school, other people not going to work.
That's fascinating. Yeah. The Austin American Statesman later reported that those arrested, 28 didn't have criminal records, and that the percentage of non-criminals arrested as part of the national operation cross-check was significantly higher in Austin than in the four other metro areas where similar operations occurred. Now, ICE officials had said the operation was focused on apprehending, quote, criminal aliens with records of violence.
All right, so this is a huge concern for a lot of places in Texas, whether or not they're considered to be a sanctuary city by either Greg Abbott or Donald Trump.
Yeah.
The LAPD this week released crime statistics that show a strong correlation between Trump's new immigration orders and reports of crime by Latino victims. So since the beginning of this year, sexual assaults reported by Latinos in Los Angeles have dropped 25%. Domestic violence reports by Latinos have decreased by 10% compared to the same period last year. When a minority community is afraid to go to the police to report sexual assaults and robberies, I mean, it emboldens criminals. It eventually endangers everyone, especially in Texas, when we have huge Latino Hispanic communities in many of our cities, especially Houston, San Antonio, Austin. We're just talking about large groups of people who don't report crime.
Yeah. I mean, this was the fear. This was the fear of what would happen. if this became law, if the Trump executive order on mass incarceration, mass deportations, this was the specific fear that people weren't going to come forward with crimes, they weren't going to come forward with their being assaulted, and it would embolden criminals to continue to do it, since they know that they can then assault and abuse those communities. And at the time, when people were assessing this and saying, no, this is what's going to happen, you had this backlash from the White House saying, oh, no, not at all. You're just being alarmist. Yeah. And then now we have the first bits of data that actually confirm those fears and actually go against what the White House predicted.
I'm waiting for the spin. There's a really easy spin, and that is, no, it's just everything's working, and the crime has actually dropped 25-10%. It's working. It's fine. Yeah. That's super unlikely.
Well, let me ask you, do you want to do the bear story or do you want to do the gay story?
You mean the nudity story? No, actual bears. I guess we could do the gay story.
You want to go gay?
I mean, not anymore.
Oh, it's gay news time. Are you ready to strike a pose? I am.
he is actually physically striking poses in the studio right now.
It's Vogue.
It's radio. Stop dancing.
All right. Well, first up with our gay news, the Texas Supreme Court is now set to hear a case regarding marriage benefits from same-sex spouses. Now, the last time we reported on this case, the case itself had been denied a hearing by the Texas Supreme Court. However, under pressure from Governor Greg Abbott, the all-Republican court reversed their decision and has allowed the trial to move forward. Republican lawmakers are suing the city of Houston for providing marriage benefits to same-sex married couples. Now, Houston is arguing that the 2015 Supreme Court ruling requires them to provide same-sex marriage benefits. Houston officials say they had no choice but to offer the benefits, since the law requires same-sex married couples to be extended the same rights as heterosexually married couples. Now, the court is expected to issue a decision by the end of June. However, regardless of how they rule, this could be a case that does reach the Supreme Court. And in Germany, Germany is set to pardon 50,000 men who were sentenced between 1945 and 1944 for the crime of being gay. Now, the German government is set to pay each of the men sentenced to prison 3,000 euros, as well as an extra 1,500 for each year that they were sentenced. Now, the law will also be done as a kind of blanket law, meaning no one will have to file any paperwork or request a pardon. Now, this has caused a lot of gay rights groups here in the U.S. to begin pressuring Congress to do something similar, specifically as it relates to the military. Now, up to 100,000 members of the U.S. military have been dishonorably discharged between World War II and the repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell in 2011 for being gay. And since 2011, those veterans were denied any rights or benefits from their services. However, in order to receive those benefits, LGBT veterans have had to go through a lengthy, years-long process in order to receive benefits or even have their military record changed. Now, since 2011, out of the estimated 100,000 people who were kicked out of the military for being gay, only 500 have been able to reclaim those benefits. And finally, in gay news, this isn't really, I think, specifically gay news, but it's kind of weird. So when Donald Trump was choosing who would become the next Supreme Court nominee, he used a list of people from the group known as Liberty Council. Now, Liberty Council is also frequently used by Republicans to receive legislation from them and then essentially write their own names on it and submit the legislation for Congress. Now, they are just a kind of nutty conservative think tank slash, conservative activist group. Now, we've also seen with this White House that they seem to rely on the initiatives and proposals sent out by Liberty Council. It is practically an academic source for them. If you need a bathroom bill or, a bill to block gay parents from adopting, they should be your first choice. So this week, Liberty Council, the go-to organization for Republicans to get their legislation from, released an amazing warning to all Republicans. They warned of a coming war with liberals. Basically, they said that Republicans and Christians will be on one side and radical gay liberals will be on the other. Now, the warning said, quote, an army of radical leftists is gathering to mobilize against President Trump's policies on the local, state, and federal levels. And they continue saying, quote, their agenda includes an aggressive pro-LGBT campaign that includes fighting against any religious liberty protections that they deem to be anti-gay offered by President Trump or Congress. The plan of this radical group are now among the biggest threats to life, liberty, and family in the history of America. So really histrionic.
That's pretty intense.
Anti-gay.
The second American Civil War will be fought with bayonets and other phallic objects.
Some martinis. I found this story really interesting because the Trump White House uses them for policy advising.
The Trump White House does a lot of outsourcing for information and policy writing, yes.
So the same people who are helping them write legislations and proposals are also saying that gay people are amassing to start a war.
Finally, a gay agenda that we'll actually see and that will make sense. Oh, it's a war? Okay, I understand that, a gay agenda. Yeah. I thought it was just brunch and this.
I do love this.
You like brunch?
No, I don't like brunch. Mm. I'm not a brunch person because I get sleepy at noon. And
you're
then
not
I'm
a
like,
big drinker either. Yeah. Like, we hang out and drink. You have one.
Yeah, I'm not a big drinker.
Yeah, because the champagne and OJ is a very, it's pretty much the whole reason you have brunch, really. From what I understand.
I think it's more of like crepes and then, tofu maybe. I don't know.
Crepes and tofu.
that's what they eat.
Can you make crepes out of tofu, you think?
I mean, this is a whole cooking conversation that I would love to have. Because crepes and pancakes and all other kinds of things are very different.
Mm-hmm.
And people confuse them all the time and, it's not good. But we do have a few...
Vogue.
We do have some other stories that we could get to, but we only have, about
2 or 3 minutes? We got about three.
All right. Well, let me see about this. So there is one thing that to keep an eye on is the Federal Elections Commission, also just known as the FEC. In January, when Donald Trump claimed that up to 5 million people voted illegally and that they all voted for Clinton, the FEC then formally asked the Trump administration to please provide evidence of that. All right? 5 million people voted illegally? Where did that happen? So according to the FEC, the White House never responded, but there were reports of White House officials being very upset at the FEC and that they would even ask for evidence to the point that the Trump White House filed preliminary ethics complaint paperwork against the FEC. Basically, the White House argued that the Federal Elections Commission asking for evidence of voter fraud in our federal elections was somehow an ethical violation. Well, earlier this month, one of the Democrats at the FEC resigned, which means that her seat on the board is now open. By tradition, the FEC board is a bipartisan 6-member board, and so Senate Democrats would be allowed to select the replacement. But by law, the choice belongs to the president, and Mr. Trump has shown, little interest in Washington customs. So the question really is, will President Trump go against decades of bipartisan agreement that the board of FEC should be a cooperative body, or will he put, someone who will listen to Donald Trump?
Yeah.
Especially after claiming that 5 million people voted illegally for Hillary Clinton.
Big claim. Yeah. Well, we saw with the wiretapping claim that apparently wiretapping was said in bunny ears. He didn't really mean wiretapping in the traditional sense of listening to your phone calls, which is all that wiretapping is. It's very specific.
Yeah.
Especially when you also tweet that the former president tapped your phones. That's a little specific, too. I'm sorry. This is a big claim. I don't really know how you weasel your way out of this one.
With the wiretapping
I'm sorry. With the 5 million people voting. I mean, the wiretapping thing, you can see how he's trying to weasel his way out and saying it was some kind of surveillance. Now the FBI is saying, people in the Trump administration were surveilled just like all Americans were surveilled. Talking about the Russian investigation. Yeah. So, maybe Trump can twist that into some kind of ammunition. But I don't know. 5 million illegal votes. He literally talked about people being bussed into other states to vote. And as far as I remember, the only people that voted illegally that were caught were people that voted for Trump more than once.
Yeah, I mean those were the only cases that ever actually came to any kind of fruition. Well, I guess that does it for us for tonight. We'll see you again next week.
Slight programming note. There still isn't a live show after us, so we're going to play an edition of Flashpoints for you.
Ooh, fun.
Ooh,
tune in.
So stay tuned for that, and then we'll get back to normal programming at 11
p.m. Get to the point. All right.
You are listening to 90.1 FM KPFT. Thank you for listening to Tell the World. We will return next week.
You are listening to KPFT Houston, which is supported in part by Houston Community College. HCC has 18 campus locations around the Houston area, as well as accessible online courses, allowing students a full range of options for their academic needs. Houston Community College offers hands-on education, one-on-one tutoring, and small class sizes with a variety of scholarship opportunities. For more information on enrollment and programs, visit hccs.edu.
Join comedian Cheech Marin as he discusses his life, touring with Tommy Chong, the world of Chicano art, and dancing with Kate Middleton at River Oaks Theater on Thursday, April 6th at 7 p.m. This ticketed author talk and book signing event is hosted by Brazos Bookstore and supported by H-Town Muse, Hawes Hill Calderon, and the Orange Show Center for Visionary Arts. Tickets must be purchased at least 24 hours in advance by calling Brazos Bookstore at 713-523-0701 or by visiting BrazosBookstore.com. Details about Cheech and his memoir can be found at CheechMarin.com/memoir. Hit it, Cheech.
KPFT Houston, yeah.